Welcome to another deep dive. We're going to be talking about stresses in the Earth's crust today. Specifically, you sent in this really cool paper from 2023 by Stefan Enkelman and Kroner. And they basically lay out this idea that we can understand a lot about where stress builds up in the Earth's crust just by knowing how the plates are moving. So that's what we're going to be looking at today. And we're going to be pairing that with some data from the World Stress Map database. It should be a really interesting deep dive.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. Because, you know, ultimately, when we think about earthquakes and all of that, it all comes down to plate tectonics.
Right.
And how these massive plates are pushing and pulling against each other.
Yeah, it's not just about the plates moving, though, right? It's about the forces that they generate in the surrounding rock.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so how do we actually picture this? Because, you know, I always think about plate tectonics as like these giant plates moving around on the surface of the Earth, but we're talking about forces. And how do we even visualize that? Especially because, you know, the Earth's a sphere, we're trying to look at it on a flat map.
That's right. That's one of the challenges.
Yeah.
You know, you're trying to take something that's three-dimensional and represent it in two dimensions, and you inevitably get some distortion. So if you think about stress, stress has a direction. And so if you were to, like, draw lines on a map to represent the direction of stress, those lines would get all warped and distorted because you're trying to flatten out a sphere.
Yeah, it's like trying to, like, flatten in an orange peel or something. You know, it's never going to be.
Exactly. It's a really good analogy. Yeah.
So how do we get around that?
Well, so this paper that you sent in, they have this really clever technique where they basically say, well, instead of using a standard map, we need to transform our view to the perspective of the stress source.
So like the plate boundary.
Like the plate boundary, exactly.
So we're kind of like tilting the map to match the angle of the plates.
That's right, yeah. And that minimizes the distortion and helps us see the true patterns of the forces. They use this example of a crater in the paper. And if you think about all the stress radiating out from that central point, on a regular map, those stress lines would look all jumbled up. But when you view it from the center of the crater, the pattern suddenly becomes really clear and symmetrical.
Yeah, so you're basically looking at it like head on instead of at an angle.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's pretty cool. So we've got this new way of looking at the data. What kind of patterns are we actually seeing?
Well, the research suggests that different types of plate boundaries create different stress patterns.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about divergent boundaries, for example, that's where the plates are moving apart from each other. If you think about pulling a piece of taffy, you're creating tension that eventually causes it to snap.
Right, and that's like those normal faults we hear about, where the Earth's crust stretches and breaks.
Yeah, exactly. And in those zones, the maximum horizontal stress, which is basically the direction of that pulling force, is perpendicular to the plate motion.
Okay.
Now, if you think about convergent boundaries, it's the opposite. Here, the plates are colliding. So instead of pulling taffy, imagine pushing two Play-Doh snakes together.
Oh, so they like buckle and fold over each other. That's what creates mountain ranges, right?
That's exactly right. And those are what we call thrust faults. And here, the maximum horizontal stress is parallel to the plate motion.
So divergent boundaries are pulling apart. Convergent boundaries are pushing together. What about those transform boundaries where plates slide past each other?
Yeah, good question. So those create shearing stress, kind of like rubbing your hands together.
Yeah.
And it leads to what we call strike slip faults, where the crust breaks horizontally. And in this case, the maximum horizontal stress is at a 45-degree angle to the plate motion.
Okay, so we've got these three basic types of plate boundaries, and they each create a distinct stress pattern. But did the researchers just stop at the theory, or did they actually test this out in the real world?
They did. They put it to the test with real-world data, and that's where the World Stress Map database comes in. They took this massive database of stress measurements from all over the planet, and they wanted to see if their model based on plate motion could accurately predict the observed stress patterns.
Okay, so they're comparing their predictions based on plate motion to actual stress measurements.
Exactly.
And what did they find?
Well, they focused on three specific case studies, each representing a different type of plate boundary. So first up, the San Andreas Fault, which is a classic example of a transform boundary.
Yeah, that's the infamous San Andreas Fault. Everyone knows about that one.
And their model's predictions lined up incredibly well with the observed stress data. It really confirmed that plate motion is the dominant driver of stress along the San Andreas Fault.
So it passed the first test with flying colors. What about the other case studies? Did those match up as well?
For the most part, yes. Their second case study focused on the Himalayas and the Tibetan Plateau, which is, you know, a massive collision zone. and a prime example of a convergent boundary.
That's where the Indian plate is slamming into the Eurasian plate, right? Pushing up those giant mountains.
Yeah, exactly. And even in this incredibly complex region, their model did a surprisingly good job of predicting the stress patterns. What's even more amazing is that their predictions were accurate, even far from the actual collision zone, showing just how far-reaching those plate boundary forces can be.
So the impact of those colliding plates extends way beyond the mountains themselves. That's pretty crazy when you think about it. Okay, so we've got transform boundaries, convergent boundaries. What about that third case study? Give us an example of those divergent boundaries in action.
Right, so for that one, they looked at the North Atlantic Ridge in Iceland, where the Eurasian and North American plates are pulling apart. And once again, their model really aced the test. There was excellent agreement between their predicted stress patterns and the actual measurements, particularly near the rift axis where those plates are actively separating.
So their model accurately predicted that the maximum horizontal stress would be perpendicular to the plate motion, just like pulling that taffy apart. Okay, so their model worked in specific locations. But here's where I think it gets really mind-blowing. Did they try applying this to the entire planet?
They did. They took their model and they applied it to the entire World Stress Map database, comparing their predictions to thousands of stress measurements from all over the globe. And the results were remarkable. Over 80% of the stress measurements taken near plate boundaries matched their model's predictions.
Wait, so you're telling me that just by understanding the direction these plates are moving, we have an 80% chance of knowing where stress is building up in the Earth's crust? That's huge for understanding, like earthquake risks and things like that.
It really is. Of course, it's not a perfect crystal ball. There are always local variations and other factors at play.
Okay, so it's a powerful tool, but not a foolproof predictor. So what are some of those other factors that might throw a wrench into the works? What causes those stress patterns to deviate from the model?
Well, even in those case studies where the model was really accurate, there were a few spots where the stress patterns didn't quite match up. You know, like that exception they found near the San Andreas Fault, the Colorado Plateau.
Yeah, they mentioned that the stress patterns there were a bit off, like something else was going on. What could cause those kind of deviations?
Oh, it's like, you know, those Where's Waldo pictures?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you need to look beyond the obvious to find what you're looking for. And in the case of the Colorado Plateau, the researchers think it might have something to do with the buoyancy of the crust in that area.
Buoyancy, like how some things float better than others.
Exactly. You know how denser objects sink, while lighter ones float? Well, the same principle applies to the Earth's crust. Denser parts want to sink, while less dense parts want to rise.
Yeah.
And those movements can actually generate stresses.
So it's like those lava lamps, you know, with the blobs of wax rising and falling because of those density differences.
Perfect analogy. And then there's something called lithospheric flexure, which is basically how the Earth's crust bends under pressure. Think of it like a diving board. The more weight you put on it, the more it bends.
And that bending creates stress within the board, or in this case, the Earth's crust.
Precisely. So while plate motion's a major player, these other forces, like buoyancy and flexure, can create their own stress patterns, especially in areas with a more complex geologic history.
Okay, so the Colorado Plateau is one puzzle piece. What about the other stress deviations they mentioned?
Well, they found some interesting anomalies in the Himalayas and the Tibetan Plateau as well. You know, this is where the Indian plate is colliding with the Eurasian plate, pushing up the highest mountains on Earth. But it's not just a simple head-on collision.
Yeah, I remember they mentioned something called lateral escape motion. What exactly is that?
Imagine you're squeezing a tube of toothpaste. The toothpaste gets pushed at the ends, right?
Right.
Well, something similar is happening in the Himalayas. All that pressure from the colliding plates is squeezing material sideways, out towards the east and west.
Ah, so it's like the Tibetan Plateau is being squeezed out.
Yeah.
From between those colliding plates.
Exactly. And that sideways flow, that lateral escape motion, is creating its own unique stress patterns. So even in a region dominated by plate collision, you can still get these localized stresses driven by other processes.
That's so cool. So the Colorado Plateau is influenced by buoyancy, the Himalayas by lateral escape motion. What about Iceland? They found some stress deviations there too, right?
They did. Remember how they looked at the North Atlantic Ridge in Iceland as an example of a divergent boundary?
Yeah.
Well, Western Iceland. They found that the stress patterns were rotating with increasing distance from the rift axis.
And if I remember correctly, they attributed that to ridge push.
Exactly. It's all about that elevated topography of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. Think of it like a conveyor belt. As new crust forms at the ridge, it pushes outwards. And that outward push, that ridge push, creates stresses in the surrounding crust. And in Western Iceland, that ridge push force seems to be strong enough to override the typical stress pattern you'd expect from simple plate divergence.
Wow, so even in areas where plates are pulling apart, those secondary forces can still have a significant impact on the stress patterns. Okay, so we've talked a lot about stress's new plate boundaries, but what about the middle of those plates, far away from those boundaries? Do stresses exist there too?
That's a great question, and it's something the paper touches on briefly. You see, their model primarily focuses on those large-scale stresses generated by plate motion, what we call first-order stresses. But the Earth's crust is a complex system, and there are other forces at play, especially when you zoom into smaller scales.
So what kinds of things could be causing stresses in the middle of a tectonic plate?
Well, you've got variations in the types of rocks and their strengths. You know, ancient fault lines that are no longer active, but still preserve stresses from past events. It's like the Earth's crust has a memory, holding on to the stresses from millions, even billions of years ago.
Wow, so these ghost stresses from the past can actually influence the stress patterns we see today.
They certainly can. And then you've got things like erosion and sedimentation, the constant wearing down and building up of the Earth's surface. All these processes contribute to the stress picture, creating a complex tapestry of forces within the Earth's crust.
So it sounds like there's a lot more to the story than just plate motion. But here's what I'm really curious about. If we can map out these stress patterns, can we actually use that information to predict earthquakes?
That's the holy grail of earthquake science, isn't it? And while this research is a huge step forward, it's not quite a crystal ball.
Oh, I figured there had to be a catch.
Understanding stress patterns is crucial, but it's only one piece of the puzzle. Think of it like trying to predict when a rubber band will snap. You might know how much tension is on it. But there are other factors that determine when and where it breaks. Things like the strength of the rubber, any nicks or weak spots, even the temperature can play a role.
So it's the same with earthquakes. There are other factors besides stress that determine when and where the Earth's crust will rupture.
Exactly. Things like the types of rocks, the presence of fluids, and the geometry of the faults themselves all play a role. And despite decades of research, earthquake prediction remains a very complex challenge.
Okay, so predicting earthquakes is still a ways off, but can we at least use this knowledge to identify areas that are more prone to earthquakes? Like, are there any red flags that geologists look for?
Absolutely. Knowing where stress is concentrated is a huge part of seismic hazard assessment. Areas near plate boundaries, especially where those stress patterns deviate from the model, are definitely high-risk zones.
Yeah, that makes sense. Those are the zones where the Earth's crust is being actively pushed, pulled, and sheared. But how do geologists actually measure the stress in the Earth's crust? It's not like they can just stick a giant pressure gauge down there.
You're right. It's a bit more indirect than that. One common technique is to analyze earthquake focal mechanisms. By studying the seismic waves generated by earthquakes, scientists can figure out the orientation of the fault that ruptured and the direction of the slip.
So each earthquake is like a mini experiment, giving us clues about the stresses that caused it.
Exactly. Another approach is to drill deep boreholes into the earth and use specialized instruments to measure the forces acting on the surrounding rock.
Wow, that sounds pretty high tech. But I imagine those measurements only give you a very localized view of the stress field.
You're right. It's like trying to understand a giant jigsaw puzzle by only looking at a few pieces. That's why it's important to combine these direct measurements with other types of data.
Like
things like geological mapping, where geologists study the rocks at the surface to understand the history of deformation, GPS measurements of surface deformation, which can reveal subtle movements of the Earth's crust. By putting all these pieces together, we can get a much clearer picture of the stress field.
It's like a detective story. You need multiple lines of evidence to crack the case.
Exactly. And the more data we gather, the better we understand those intricate forces shaping our planet. You know, so far we've focused on the natural stresses generated by plate motion and other geologic processes. But what about the stresses caused by human activities? Do those play a role in the bigger picture?
You mean like how some people think fracking can cause earthquakes?
Exactly. Activities like fracking, wastewater injection, even large-scale mining operations can actually change the stress field in the Earth's crust. And sometimes those changes can be enough to trigger earthquakes, especially in areas that are already under a lot of stress.
So it's like we're adding fuel to the fire.
That's a good way to put it. Think of it like this. Imagine a stack of blocks that's just barely balanced. If you add even a tiny bit more weight, The whole thing could come tumbling down.
Okay, that's a little unsettling. But how do these human-induced stresses compare to the natural stresses caused by plate motion? Are they just a drop in the bucket?
Well, it all depends on the scale you're looking at, on a global scale. Those tectonic forces are far more powerful than anything humans can produce. But when you zoom in to a local level, those human-caused stresses can be significant enough to tip the scales and trigger earthquakes.
So it's a reminder that even though we're tiny compared to the Earth, our actions can still have a real impact.
Absolutely. And it highlights the importance of understanding these processes so we can manage resources responsibly and minimize any potential risks.
This has been such a fascinating deep dive. We've covered so much ground, from those massive tectonic forces shaping our planet to those subtle but significant human-induced stresses.
Yeah, we've explored how scientists measure these stresses, how they relate to earthquake hazards, and how even the way we visualize data can change our understanding.
And I think the biggest takeaway for me is that the Earth is a dynamic, ever-changing system. We're not just passive passengers on this planet. Our actions can actually influence these powerful forces that are constantly at play.
I think that's a great point to end on. We've only scratched the surface today, but hopefully you've gained a new appreciation for the awesome power and complexity of our planet. And who knows, maybe this deep dive will spark a lifelong fascination with Earth science.
So keep exploring, keep asking questions, and never lose that sense of wonder. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.